Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Success isn't a goal, it's a journey. I interview the most incredible humans to keep your mind optimized for growth. Welcome to the podcast, Chris. It's lovely to have you. I found out about you from your sister, who was on the podcast 20 or so episodes ago, who was a bundle of joy. And I'd been getting more into startup and VCs recently, so she said I should talk to you. So it's my pleasure to have you here. And it seems like you've done a lot of interesting things from your LinkedIn. So I thought it'd be nice for you to give us a bit of an introduction to your life story, sort of where have you come from, what are the different things you've done, and like some of the highlights, if you could, please.
Sure. And yeah, it's great to be here and thanks for having me on. In terms of my background, my career into VC started long before I actually imagined. I was always very, very passionately involved with technology from a young age. And on my 13th birthday, I had a little bit of pocket money and I recently just bought an iPod. This is before iPods were cool and only creatives had Mac. And then I used a little bit of pocket money and asked my father, that said, you know what, can you put a little bit of money into Apple shares for me? And after that, the rest is kind of a little bit of history. I left those shares for a long period of time. I think it was 10 years in the end. And I should have bought more. But every time I bought a Mac product, I should have probably bought more shares. I would have been much better off in life. But I was always passionate about technology because I always saw it as a way to kind of increase efficiency and change people's lives in different ways. So when I graduated from Durham, and joined EY in the strategy technology division and worked for some really big organizations for 4 years doing all sorts of stuff. And then I just quit one day. I thought, I've got my accountancy qualification. I'm going to leave. I'm going to do something different. But I wanted to do something in technology. I was very passionate about entrepreneurship, had a few ideas, but quickly realized I would be a really terrible founder. And so I thought, I'm not going to be a founder. And also statistically, being a founder is probably not like a good thing. A, because I'm probably not the right person to be a founder. And B, I put my success chances at probably like 1%. So I was like, how do I increase my odds in this scenario? So what I did is I got involved in a number of different startups, actually angel invest in a number of different startups, all within technology, financial services, gaming, various different things. And essentially what I felt with those early startups in my angel investing career, that was all, I'm almost part of the founding team. So, you know, I was investing, you know, relatively small amounts of money, but I had quite a big equity percentage because I was working 2-3 days a week on each startup, but I thought that would hedge my bet. But this also gave me the experience to have like operating experience in startups. So if I ever became like a more of a serial investor, I could sit down with the founder and be like, look, I've been there, I've done this, I've had the co-founder leave, I've had us running out of cash, I've had companies going bust, I've had explosive growth, I've had selling of a company. And so that's exactly what did happen in that journey. Wild failure. One is still going today and is kind of a great business and grows nicely, but it's not like what we call in the industry, like it's not like going to be a home run investment, but it's going to do quite nicely for the investors over a period of time. And then one, luckily, we grew nicely and we sold earlier this year, which was a nice exit for myself and the investors and also the other founders of the company. So this has been my journey today and has been a really interesting journey. I think personally and through RLC Ventures Funds, who now I run my own VC firm, which is called RLC Ventures. And we are early stage investors in seed businesses, particularly in three areas, which are entertainment, financial services, and enterprise businesses. So these are the three areas that we kind of specialize in and the team specialize in. When I transitioned from doing those angel investments into VC, we took a different mindset to this. And I know the podcast about mindset, and we could touch a little bit about how we kind of tried to change the game slightly in the VC space later. But that's a brief career journey to date. I think now I've made 50 investments across the world. Some of them have become massive companies and some of them have been absolute disasters, but this is the nature of the game. And I was lucky to be voted by my founders as like the top Asian tech investor in the UK last year, which was a really great privilege. But this is nothing to do with how good I am investing. It's just because our founders, I think, are very complimentary of our firm.
Nice. Well, yeah, lots of interesting things to dive into. So did you have to argue a lot for getting your dad to buy you some Apple shares? Or was he kind of like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's sort of teach him about money and sort of see what happens.
Yeah, I think now we look at Apple, this Goliath $1 trillion company. And at the time, it just wasn't that company. It was for those creatives. It was for the video editors in a dark studio. The iPod wasn't really a thing. It was nowhere near what people think of it as today. And, you know, I walked into my school with the iPod and people generally laughed. There was a Microsoft equivalent at the time. I think somebody said, like, why haven't you got the Microsoft product? And I was like, oh, because I remember that back then they didn't have like a USB cable. You had to get some funny adapter to plug it into a PC. If you had a PC, it was something called FireWire or something like that, right? You didn't even get like a USB. So it was like crazy. And people thought I was crazy. And so they'd invest in the stock. People think I was crazy. And, you know, Steve Jobs is often idolizing the business community. But I think it wasn't foresight in terms of like, I didn't think the stock would do well or whatever. I just liked the product. And I think that's kind of where I've kind of homed in on my investing career more than anything, that I just get into the product. And I think often people forget that like a beginner's mindset to something is actually like a really powerful thing. And often when I get like interns to work at RLC Ventures, I often give them quite hard, challenging questions. And I want to see how someone else comes with no preconceived conceptions into something. And I think this is often a powerful thing that people maybe don't use a lot in life sometimes, when it's often a great skill to have.
Yeah, definitely. It's, if you think about like most of the systems that we have and like the rules, like they're all quite old, but they're kind of running because they haven't necessarily broken, but perhaps they are more broken than you realize. You know, to think to question them, and we really should. But that's sort of how you become like a founder in things, is just looking at the world and seeing what you could change about it. So yeah, having like a clean slate to sort of think from, as opposed to like, oh, this is how things work and this is just what you do, is really useful. But on the other side, having lots of experience and understanding different intricacies of everything and how that can apply to new things is also good. So I think if you have like experience in one industry and then go to a new industry, it's really helpful from what I've heard. So would you say that's part of your job as a VC then, is to kind of read as much as you can and be just like super interested in like lots of different industries to become kind of knowledgeable as to how? So sure, you invest in media, but is it worth sort of looking into other areas of the world to sort of see how maybe media is going to be affected by what other changes are coming and stuff?
This is a good question. I think as a VC, you constantly need to be on top of trends. You constantly need to see where direction of the world is going. Let's take podcasting. The Spotify chief content officer was on CNBC today, and they were saying something like 86 million people or something like that, in the 80 million people were listening to podcasts last year in America. And I think they said they think it's like almost doubled. And, you know, like with Joe Rogan, they bought their rights for 100 million. I wouldn't say it's come from nowhere, but like suddenly people like wake to like the power of it. And this is a new media experience. And now if you had been sleeping under a rock for the last kind of 3-4 years about podcasts and the power of them, then suddenly you might be waking up now. But it's almost like a little bit too late in a lot of ways in terms of investing category winners. I'm sure there will be some really good things to come out, but I think there'll be some really big companies coming out. But in general, I think the theme, for example, we have, was we often have a theme around something. So for example, we have a really strong theme about audio, just generally in audio. We think audio businesses, so for example, we invested in a company called Labworks, which is one of the leading producers of Alexa games. So you play quiz games, and 5 million people have played their games, but you've never even heard of this company, right? And then think something like audio, for example, and this is where our firm is, we really believe in having an impact more than just the investment. Obviously, financial returns, very important, but a lot of people can't play video games because they might be impaired with sight. So something like Labworks, where you can play a conversational game with somebody over Alexa, is empowering a lot of people to have entertainment that they wouldn't have previously. Older generations, people that are visually impaired, etc. So this is a classic thing that we think can make good money and make a return for our investors and ourselves, but then also impact society in a way that is positive and also meaningful.
Yeah, that's really cool. So how do you go around sort of staying on top of these things? Do you sort of have a habit of listening to it, like reading a book a week, or sort of going to lots of industry conferences? What is it you kind of need to do, as well as trying to stay on top of like all the companies that you do have and meeting all new companies and things?
I think discussions with our internal team are very important. We all read a lot of stuff. So we have everything, you know, set up in like Notion and Airtable and various different tools. I think personally for me, Notion is the one that I use the most in terms of like just idea generation, capture. And so that is really important. I think internally as a firm, put together a weekly newsletter, which we gather a lot of data around the funding landscape, called Seed Weekly, if people want to subscribe. And basically it tells people like what the company has been funded in what sectors. So often from this, we can see like what trends are there in the market, what kind of funding has gone to what kind of companies, which is very powerful because we can see like, oh, there's loads of money going into enterprise software at the moment, or entertainment or games or whatever it may be, fintech or specific area in fintech, it might be payments. So I think that's a good way that we keep up, which is a bit different. And then, yeah, things like podcasts, we try and like have daily Google alerts set up in areas that we're interested in or topics we're interested in. But I think for me, I like, you know, talking to people to understand an industry. So often I will speak to other VCs, other founders, like I usually check in with the founders like once a week or once every other week, just for a general catch up of, you know, sometimes we don't talk about the company. We, you know, talk about the industry, or they might have seen another sector that's interesting. But I think the key to our industry and the key to what I found is you've just got to have an open mind. You know, who thought games on Alexa would be a thing, right? Like something that people wouldn't have thought about. And we've just invested in another company, which I can't say the name of it, but it's almost like a workers' rights private union style company. And during COVID, they went from 40,000 users to like 400,000 users because they managed to make some really amazing changes. So these businesses are like kind of slowly changing the way people work with companies or work or interact with things.
Do you think one of the key elements to be successful as a VC is just to be really curious and just be interested in all these things?
Curiosity is absolutely fundamental to the job, for sure. It's one of those jobs where kind of as a partner, you have to go and make something happen for yourself. It's not going to be like you're at Goldman Sachs or something, or where people's like, here's a pack, go away and do this analysis. And you have to like create something. You have to go and see a founder. You have to go and speak at a conference or speak to another VC, or like you create a brand around your firm so people come towards you. You have to create all that. It's almost a startup in itself in the way you look at it. And then if you're a founder of a startup, you would inquisitively want to know about the industry. And I think a lot of people ask me, like, do you actually generally enjoy VC? I think people forget it's like actually an investing career. A lot of people think it's about working with founders all the time and like helping them and sitting on boards and like, et cetera. But I actually, you have to generally enjoy investing. It's actually in the job title. And people, I think, kind of get lost and forget that a little bit sometimes with VC.
Yeah, it's a bit of an unknown world if you're not in it so much. A few years ago, I kind of just assumed that you had to be like super mega rich kind of own one. Like I spoke to some people that had started them and they were like, wait, you got other people or like funds to give you money and you just sort of started like making bets on things? Like, what the hell? How does that happen? And yes, yeah, it's kind of confusing that it's not quite what you could have had in your head at all.
You may have heard about Feels CBD, but let me tell you why I love it. It's a great and natural way to relieve chronic pain, stress, and anxiety. And as a full-time CEO of a cash-strapped startup, I'm trying to do a million things at once, and I experience a good level of stress every day, and Feels helps me ride the waves a little bit, getting regular sleep, which I think is the most important thing to just keep your sanity and your health in check. So Feels helps you just have a natural night of sleep and wake up feeling great. What is Feels? It's a premium CBD delivered direct to your door, and it's easy to take with a few drops under the tongue and you're good to go. They have a support hotline with real humans if you really need it. And remember that it does work naturally with no high or hangover or addiction. You can join their membership to save money on every order. And if you sign up now at feels.com/growth, you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. Now that's Feels, which is FEALS.com/growth to become a member now with 50% off and free shipping. Feels.com/growth.
So let's backtrack a bit to when you left EY then. You worked in quite a few different startups. Do you think now that there are signs in the ones that failed or succeeded that you could have picked up on?
I think there's an analogy in VC, which is like you kind of have to lose money to make money, and you kind of have to earn your stripes a little bit going through those things. And I'm a big believer in terms of mindset is that I did an international business degree at Durham. I did an accounting qualification at EY. And yes, definitely they gave me some good principles and foundations, but they're not going to teach you to negotiate with a founder. It's not going to teach you to understand how corporate law works and legal terms work and, you know, what happens when a founder leaves, or, you know, you have to make a company go into administration, or you have to sell a company. So these things, no matter how much you try and learn about them, you just can't, I think, until you've literally, are you down there fighting for your lives or to survive. And I think in terms of stories, one of the company that we actually sold was a company that was started by a very young person. The founders came out of uni. And so originally we were all quite ambitious and we all wanted to, like, the company to do extremely well. But there was a period of like a year where there was generally just like a learning curve about how to run a company, which somebody who maybe had been a bit more down the road in their career wouldn't have to go through. And a year is quite a long time in the startup world to kind of just learn, right? And you just got to understand. So I think my lessons were that you can't teach the nuances of being a founder very easily. It can't be taught on a whiteboard, and it can't be taught reading too many nonfiction books.
Those things help when you're actually doing it. It's just very abstract and you kind of forget about it and you can't really see what it means. But I've certainly read some books and then like read them again a few years later and be like, oh my God, this book is like 10 times better than I realized the first time.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's one habit that I've really learned in the recent years is that actually it's not the quantum of what you read, it's how you digest it. And that's why I find Notion very useful, because I've now gone to a method of actually going back and just reading a chapter, digesting it, making some notes and really absorbing that. And rather than try and constantly just like absorb, because I, you know, a lot of my friends, they love all these nonfiction books and Shoe Dog and all these great things, which are great stories, great book, but actually they don't apply it. So what's the point of reading all this stuff if you can't apply it and you don't remember it?
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel, because it's sort of, it just seems like you're kind of just distracting yourself, really, if that's all you do, especially if you listen to too much stuff. So like with podcasts, I actually stop at the end of each podcast and kind of I have a conversation with myself. I ask myself what I learned and like what I might need to do, and sort of like if I'm like running or something, I don't have time to like make notes, but I'll actually sort of speak the words out loud, so I actually kind of remember something and like put the ideas in my head into sort of something I can explain, and like I'm more likely to actually make notes when I get back. And I've been doing a book club now with a friend as a podcast, so we like read a book a week and actually sort of explain it to each other and talk about like how it applies to our lives and things. And it's just, I have such a clearer mental image of those things now compared to like the books I was reading before it, and it just seems so pointless to not. But it kind of leads into what I was doing with my app, like I was explaining to you earlier, the Syncify app, which lets you listen to podcasts and books together. I've never been able to listen to like a book chapter by chapter with someone, but it's so cool if you're watching a TV series, like at each episode you can actually chat about it like each week. But like, why can't you do that with a book? Because there's so much stuff within the book that is more granular than the whole book, which someone reads it like a month later, you can say like, yeah, it was good, I learned some things. Whereas like each bit is actually really good, and you can like go much deeper on it when you actually have the ability, when someone's at the same place with you. So kind of excited to be able to do that more with people. Back to ways of learning and stuff, can you explain maybe what went wrong with like the startup that you said exploded, without kind of saying anything bad?
Yeah, I think great founders are amazing at getting great people on their journey and aligning them to a single goal. And the best founders get people around them quickly that are smarter than them. This is the key. And this is one thing we really look for. Like, who have you been able to hire? Who is going to be your first hire? Why would they come on you? Have you worked with them before? These are a lot of questions we dig into with people, because I think my experience of the startups that haven't done so well is that they haven't been able to keep and retain talent. Because I think if you really believe in that mission, that person, et cetera, you will go, you will take a salary cut. You would really like go to the end of the earth. You'll be putting in the hours. You'll be really building that company with them. And no great thing in this world has been done by one individual, right? You need to be able to bring people around you to succeed. And so if you don't have that skill in your founding team, I think this makes us very, very hard. And so I think where the startup that failed went wrong was, one, I think the founding team weren't on the same page, and one of them left within about a year of the firm. Secondly, they raised a lot of money, but they didn't really have enough traction, in the sense that they didn't have like a product market fit, as they say in the industry. They didn't have something. And then when they didn't do that, they changed their strategy like in the middle of it. And I think they lost faith with a lot of investors. So you have to really communicate well to people while you're doing things. And I think, you know, that's courage, that's leadership, knowing your weaknesses, knowing your strengths, and taking people on a journey. So I think those are the main things that I would partake impart on people if they're listening. I'll partake.
Interesting. Okay, and then the other way around, about the one that was the most successful, what do you think was the key sort of elements behind that, the story?
I think as a story, this individual became an individual by the end, was just a learning machine. He just absorbed everything. He was probably one of the weakest founders in the portfolio, I would say, when he first came on board, but his growth was just exponential. He just had this complete learner's mindset to everything. I remember him coming to our first pitch event, and I was just like, this guy is useless at pitching, like useless. I was like, nobody is going to like believe what he's saying. He's a good, quite technical guy, and but he's got a good product, but you have to really sell the dream at some level to people, stakeholders, wider stakeholders. And by the end of the journey, he sold the company and he was just amazing. I remember him for his last meeting with me and he was doing a pitch. He said he practiced that pitch 35 times that in the morning and it showed. And he took feedback on, he respected people's opinions. He listened to himself and he just got it done. He had so many setbacks, like it would have broken so many people. I can't even describe the setbacks he had, people leaving, him nearly running out of money, being a tough industry, huge competition, billions of people trying to outspend him on marketing, consumer business, like literally everything you could think of that would probably go against the founder. And he came out successful. And that's, we're talking about mindset. That is a great example of mindset and how it can get you to a place where we'll learn something from. And I certainly did. And he expanded my thinking for sure. And that's a great part of my job, actually, because I learn every day. And that's what's amazing about it.
That sounds really interesting journey to have been a part of. So at what point did you realize that you could set up a VC from just like your current investments? And like, how did you actually go around doing that?
That's a good question. So as I was going on this journey with like kind of operating these startups, which I had kind of got involved with, other people started asking me, next time you get involved in a startup, I want to be involved in a startup. I find what you've been doing is interesting. And can I like invest with you or do something with you? And so basically it snowballed from there. And I just started to get my friends to invest with me. And then eventually it snowballed and we made some good returns and we raised a fund and now basically raise another fund and basically kind of snowballed indirectly. I never really thought of it as a full-time thing, but what really happened was I just kept following my passion and now it's become something and we've got a long way to go, but it's a start and you know we're on the right trajectory, I think, as a firm.
It does seem like there's a bit of a jump between investing with some friends and raising a fund, at least someone like me. How did you then take that forward? Sure. Did you sort of write a plan of like, hey, I've been investing sort of like 10,000 amounts or like 50,000, maybe you should just give us 5 million?
It's a painful process and takes a long time, and you know you start off small and often those people that were investing with your friends became investors in the fund. And so it kind of was a natural evolution. And so that was really how we took it. We took it like, right, we can't do this like deal by deal anymore. It doesn't make sense. It's got too messy, too, you know, we need to scale it up. And so we said to people, like, stop investing deal by deal, invest in the fund. And they did that. And we were lucky that some of those people then introduced us to other people who then invested in the fund. And that's kind of the story. It's like anything sales orientated. You get a lot of setback. People think you're good enough. They don't think you've been in the industry long enough. They think you're too young, all these things. But, you know, every time someone came back, I said, that's feedback. I'm going to go and fix that again and again. And that's how we kind of made the jump to kind of, instead of, I would say, like managing people's money, instead of them putting it into a specific deal that we were working on or working with a founder on.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Sounds like it's like a huge chasm, yeah. Like having a fund and sort of just doing some investing, but it's just sort of, okay, when you're doing quite a bit of investing with other people, you sort of change the mechanics of how it's going and actually it does make sense. Cool, thanks.
Join over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional with BetterHelp. It's a sponsor of this podcast and they're just really great and hopefully it can help you with any of the problems that you have. I genuinely struggle from a diagnosed condition of needing too much adventure and thrill seeking. But during lockdown, this actually kind of came out in some weird ways. And sometimes when I'd be recording the podcast, I'd be talking to someone in the interview and I would just mute the sound on my headphones. So I'd have no idea what they were saying. And I'd just try and carry on with the interview and see if I could do it without anyone noticing. I have no idea why I did that. Yeah, there's something wrong with me. Hence why I needed counseling. BetterHelp really helped me find healthier ways to exist as a human in this crazy world. They assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's professional counseling done securely online with all types of counselors in different professions, and you can access it from anywhere in the world. It's really convenient. So yeah, this is a special offer for Growth Mindset podcast listeners. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/growthmindsetpodcast.
In terms of growing that, you then sort of, once you've had experience managing like a fund that isn't huge, can then be like, actually, maybe we're worth having like a 50 million fund and kind of go out for like bigger partners.
We're not quite there yet, but I think, you know, definitely on the road. And again, what goes back to, we're a startup VC. And so we need to differentiate. We need to get great people around the table. At the end of the day, cash can be a commodity, right? So what sets the great investors apart is really their founders that they invest in. If you think of the great investors of our time, the likes of Okoye and Michael Morritt, who's actually Welsh. So he's probably the most renowned and well-known venture capitalist, definitely in the UK, I would say, but lives in Silicon Valley and net worth in the billions, you know, obviously backing great companies over the years. There's so many of them. And so we spend a lot of time kind of, you know, promoting our brand and working with entrepreneurs. So we get good references. We're very proud of what we've achieved in that space so far.
And it's certainly not an industry for people with like a lack of patience, because I guess if even if you do invest in like something that's going to be huge, you still have to wait a few years for it to really become what you want. Have you had to learn patience? Because it sounded like in hindsight, like you had a very sort of thought out plan around what you did of like, oh, I'll leave EY and become like this sort of startup, super knowledgeable human. Or was it just a bit of a random, like, oh, it's mates starting a thing. I guess I've got a bit of money, I can invest in it.
Curiosity often gets you to those places and answering questions. You know, I'm a big believer in skill that I constantly practice is listening. I listen to entrepreneurs all day and, you know, you have two ears and one mouth. That's the analogy. So you listen twice as much as you speak. And people like Socrates are very focused on asking questions that get really, if you answer the right questions, you get the really good answers. And that's how you really understand other humans, understand the way somebody else thinks. And that's a skill I like to practice a lot. And I suppose that skill ends up being curiosity, like in a different way. And having an open mindset and allowing things to flow, often you don't know where you're going to end up. So sometimes such a rigid plan is actually the vision I always had was I'm just going to be part of companies that change the way people do things, right? And that was always my mindset. And when I was at EY, even though I was working for huge companies like EDF Energy and all these other huge FTSE 100 companies, I didn't feel like I was part of a company or doing something that would change the way people do something on a daily basis. And so this was my internal drive, and it externally manifested itself in this career, basically, because I think for me, I could have the most output on the most amount of people with my time doing this. And that's how I kind of almost fell into it.
So what would you say, as in now that you've been doing more VC, is like the things that you're looking for in founders? Because you've mentioned that you're kind of looking for like the best founders, essentially, but how do you quickly work that out? Because of over the process of a year, you get to see how someone is, and like you get to notice that they really like a great learner and they can deal with like things with like resilience. But how do you notice that in like a sort of 10 minute interview, or if they just send you an email asking you to invest, how do you sort of know that they're worth like looking into?
We get so many decks and so many people come through our door. I think we have 1,500 applications a year. It's around that figure, which is crazy if you think about it. And VC generally, they invest in less than 1% of the kind of companies out there. I think it's important to note that not every business is VC backable, because they're looking for very certain characteristics. You know, can it scale very quickly? Are they big markets? But the ideal investment for VC is like SAP, 10 people in a room creating a $1 billion company, right? That's like the dream, right? You don't want like, it's very scalable. It doesn't need huge operations. It's software based, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just a caveat for all. So a lot of people that come through our door, there's nothing actually fundamentally wrong with their business, or it's not that it's not a good business. Because VCs, the way the model works is that you invest in 20 companies and two make all your money, right? That's the statistics. And so if those two are going to make you money, they're going to have to make you 50 to 100 times your money to make up for all of the other stuff that is not going to make you money. And so you might come to me and say, right, I'm going to make this business and I'm going to make a £30 million business. I'm going to be multimillionaire and that's going to be great. And I'm happy with that. But actually a VC will look at that and be like, my fund is 30 million. If you make a £30 million business and I own 10% of that, I've only made 3 million. And so therefore this isn't going to return my fund, because this is the idea that one investment will return their fund. And so basically that's one thing. Second thing is that you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. The amount of decks and first impressions and first emails I get where people haven't done any research on us, they haven't even bothered to put the deck in PowerPoint 99, you know, together, and like fonts are a different size, and they haven't put any kind of effort into actually the presentation. You know, I mean, the first thing I would do just on the initial thing is like, right, let's look at the website, let's look at the founding team's LinkedIn, and often their LinkedIn profile tells you a lot about their personality and character, and often how they came to us is another way, because the VC market is often notorious for warm intros, and a lot of VCs will say, we invested in a company that cold emailed us recently. However, often the best way to get into VC in terms of getting in front of them is through warm intros. And if you get a warm intro, that shows a level of kind of hustle for a founder, because they've had to go and find somebody, get that person to then intro you them to you. That shows some kind of characteristic in them. So these are all like little clues that you pick up very early on, how responsive they are on emails, etc. Then obviously when you meet them, there's a different story. Then there's lots of things that we go through in terms of testing personalities, tests of resilience. And, you know, it does take time. And obviously with COVID, it takes a little bit longer than we usually do. So yeah, it's not one set formula. You pick up small things along the way that you kind of see signs of.
Cool. And then, so once you've gone through that to the point where you're then meeting in person, what are the sort of questions that you're asking to sort of see that this person is going to be the right type of founder?
Yeah, I think it's just mainly around a couple of things. Firstly, often it's two people. So have they got the right relationship? Are they fully committed? That's something that's big for us. Have they got the right skills? So often you'll find one co-founder, which is a bit more of a technical co-founder versus the other. And are they balanced? Are they going to fall out? I think the biggest risk I've seen in early stage startups is founders falling out with each other. This happens more than people think. And for us, are they like coachable in a sense that we have this methodology of like, you know, we don't tell founders what to do, but we like people that can receive feedback if they and ask for feedback. You know, for us, that's so important because VC is like longer than most people's personal relationships and marriages, girlfriends, etc. And so, you know, you're going to be a lot with these people a long time. So you better get on with them and you better want to do business with them. So that's something obviously we look for. And then obviously, why are they doing something like this? Is it just because they think they're going to make money? What is their purpose? Have they often, the great founders that we've invested have been driven from a place of maybe pain or frustration, or they've experienced something they just could not sleep until they basically go and solve that problem. So that's what we look for more than anything. And then I mentioned previously about the team and how can they inspire people on that journey and bring people on that journey, and you know, what other people say about them. So those are the kind of, I would say, high level things we really look for.
Cool. That's a very useful set of questions. Thanks. Certainly very useful for me making notes for my own business of questions to be answering, and anyone looking to kind of hire, well, looking to get a VC. So what do you think it's going to be the big changes that are coming over the next 5 years, and from all like your reading around sort of topics and what you want to be investing in, like where do you see is like a major shift in how humans interact into the 5 years time?
Yeah. So you're going to quote me on this podcast and 5 years time, you're going to come and email me and say, oh, you're completely wrong. And so it's hard making predictions as anyone can imagine. But I think the one that really stands out to me as a person that through my whole life, I've struggled, I have dyslexia. So I've always kind of found different ways, you know, and my teachers were like, you're not going to even pass your GCSEs, you know, and I was like, F you, no. And then I, you know, emailed them my Durham degree certificate afterwards. And so I think for me, the way people learn particularly, I think is it needs to be kind of changed significantly. I realized very late on in life that I take a lot of knowledge from reading books. I love reading books and I listen to Audible and do all that stuff. And it's great, and podcasts and stuff. But like the way I personally learn is really like audio and visual learning. So I will remember personally, this for me, I will remember something like random video that like my history teacher taught, like showed me about World War II. But I can't remember any topics he said in terms of that day or course or whatever, because that's the way I learn. And I think for me, the way people digest content needs to change. It's brilliant what you're doing. And I think the idea about the book thing is great, because people need to use all of their senses to learn about subject or get passionate about subject. And I think this as a topic is, I think, going to change significantly in the next 5 years. And we've seen the rise of things like masterclass. You know, I've got a friend of mine who like knows nothing about cooking, but then just picked up Wolfgang Puck and masterclass and just suddenly fell in love with cooking. And like learning should be about, right? Like you're learning from the best in a way that's digestible, and also in a format. And the format I think is shifting, right? It's shifting from like a more like textbook rigid format to like audio, potentially like AR, various different ways of working. So that's what I think is really like, I think a big trend that's kind of come in the next 5 years or so.
I 100% agree with you there. So it's nice to hear. And I think it's, we're both people that are just super curious and trying to learn as much as possible. We kind of really pick up on where the problems are and like how it could be smoother and better. And like, yeah, it's just definitely a place for innovation. It's going to be fun. So any other things in life that you think have been super useful in terms of, you know, have you gotten to like running marathons or like mindset shifts?
I mean, I climbed Kilimanjaro about 5 or 6 years ago. I'm probably a bit more than that, actually. And I think mindset shifts often come, in my experience, from a place of maybe suffering, but pain often. And I think that often when you're in those places that you don't really know what's kind of happening to you. And I think for me, you know, actually looking back on what I wish I knew now, where I wish I knew earlier, is that the main thing on mindset I've learned, and it's only come to me in the last few years, is that you actually control what your brain processes in terms of mindset. And so this is like a concept that people take a long time to really understand. Like, for example, Kilimanjaro, it's actually not a physical challenge. It's actually a mental challenge. It's actually really like how you process the challenge in your brain to get to the top. And, you know, there's some very, very profound books and thinking around this subject for many, many centuries. And it actually has a lot of roots in religion, and it has a lot of roots in philosophy. And I think there's some great books on the subject. For example, The New Earth, I think it's called. Yeah. And I think this book is very interesting because actually it comes from a place where it's not like trying to sell you something. It's actually trying to actually just really understand how your brain and your kind of ego actually plays. So in my opinion, if you can sort out that, you literally can conquer anything in your life. You literally can process any bad experience in a way that's positive. You can literally turn anything that's happened to you in a way that's like, actually, you know what? I'm going to use that to my advantage. For example, oh, my co-founder's left. Okay, well, now I've got an opportunity to get a better co-founder. Okay, I've run out of money. Okay, well, I'm going to find some money, or I'm going to structure something in a different way. I'm going to get a bounce back loan from the government, whatever.
Yeah, I think some of it comes from experience of having things go wrong and seeing that they kind of always work out anyway, so you don't need to panic so much, instead of being able to like look for the good things. And I mean, I managed to smash my femur last year whilst I was kite surfing, and I thought I might be dying, but I spent the whole like time in the ambulance sort of joking and having a nice time, and then wasn't sure what happened. But I was like, well, you know, maybe I'll be in a wheelchair the rest of my life, maybe I won't have a leg, but that could be good. I'll spend more time writing and doing all these useful things that I haven't been doing yet. So there's always like good things to be positive about. And like you say, it is just how you think about the thing that happens. There is no such thing as like good and bad exactly, or like scary or not scary. It's sort of, it's just what your brain chooses to do, if you can kind of sit there and like actually have the filter between the reaction and the actual stimulus, which is not exactly the easiest thing to learn. So I did read your book list actually, and did have quite a few that I thought were really good, and I've now forgotten which ones are on there. Have you got any like one book that you think has most impacted your skills as an investor?
I think as an investor, two books. One would be Peter Thiel's 0 to 1, which is, he was, I think, one of probably the first investor in Facebook, and he was a co-founder of PayPal, and so quite a notorious Silicon Valley investor. But this was a very simple short book and really kind of gives people the foundation of understanding the mechanics and what you look for in companies in VC, for example, like monopolistic markets, etc. And the second book is Venture Deals by Brad Fell. And this, it gives you the foundation of VC personally, like how like structure works, how financing works, how terms works. And it kind of just lifts a lid on quite an opaque industry and makes it very transparent. And I think that book does a great job. I give it to all my team. So go read this first and come back to me when you've read it.
Definitely. It's really awesome. I've read about it. Well, I read it like a few years ago when I was starting a different company and we were sort of looking into doing VC stuff. But then that one kind of blew up spectacularly, which was fun. But in terms of the 0 to 1, I didn't like it quite as much as everyone else seems to. I'm not sure why. It felt like a lot of different blogs, some of them like really good ideas, but just like kind of short. And I kind of felt like I wanted to elaborate a bit more. But like each one was really useful as a piece of information. So it wasn't bad in that sense.
Yeah, I can see exactly why you came from that mindset. I think it's one of those things that after I picked it up after making a few investments, and I was like, probably should have read this before I made those investments kind of thing. And so that's why it's a little bit more powerful for me.
Maybe I should read it again. Like I built a tool that let me kind of just scrape blogs and then turn it into like an ebook for myself, and like so I could send it to my Kindle. So I did that with like Paul Graham's, like all his essays, and I thought like I found those kind of a bit more useful as a writer. But I should probably revisit the Peter Thiel thing, because that was like 4 years ago or something. I read it, so I should do that again.
Right.
But yeah, having like people's blogs was quite useful, because like, there's a lot of books that are kind of just blogs, and you're like, there's probably some better blogs out there if you sort of went and looked into it. And like, I kind of got annoyed with having Pocket on my phone, because there's so much great content, but I felt like overwhelmed by the need to constantly consume content and never have like my brain free. Like, so I just felt like every single second that I was like in a queue or sort of sitting on a plane or something, I was just constantly like reading, because like I'm curious, and so I was always doing useful stuff. But it just felt like actually like my brain actually sort of should be digesting these things and thinking as well. So then And I figured like having those things on my Kindle is like, okay, it's a bit more of a, I'm going to think about when I'm going to read and like spend the time doing these things and like have a bit more control in myself, which is quite nice. Probably decent with that tool, but you know, it solved my problem. And that was enough.
Good solution.
Definitely. Like how about family? Because obviously your sister's done some pretty cool things. Do you think you guys like sparked each other at all? Or is it just a very sort of random that you just happened to go into doing like different cool things? Because your mum, I know, was like a life coach. Do you think she influenced you guys a lot?
I would say me and particularly Leah have always been competitive people. She's always been somebody that looks at me and says, I'm going to beat him. If he's going to do that, I'm going to do a half marathon. I'm going to do a marathon. And so it's always, you know, that kind of sibling kind of, we support each other and definitely kind of push each other on. I think the bedrock of any success I would have had in my life is because I've had this family that is extremely supportive and we're all like entrepreneurs in a weird way. And, you know, my wider family as well. And so to have phone call with somebody who's been there or done that or can pick you up a little bit when you're having a bad day or can work through a problem in a way which is like non-judgmental is like basically having like a board of directors. And so this is an incredibly powerful thing that I've blessed to really have, and I'm very thankful to have it because I don't think I would be where I am today without that support and network.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you said that, because of I've got a sister who we're not so like competitive between each other, I guess, but in terms of like my family have done like they've run a few businesses and done different things as well, and they've been so useful in my own businesses before as people to call. And we did spend the last few months maybe not always going in the right directions and things, and like actually last week I got my family to kind of be just like a board of directors until we sort of appoint real ones, and it's just been so useful like actually having them, like getting my co-founders on the call and just sort of sitting around and kind of discussing through like our biggest issues, and it's actually really helpful, even though it seems a bit odd to be like telling my co-founder like, right, so we're gonna go talk to my mum and dad and sister about like what's going on in the business, and we'll just have like a weekly call for like half an hour and like playing things.
Great idea.
But yeah, it's been super useful. Yeah, it's good. It's not exactly like a tip for people who haven't got a family that can do that, but certainly it's very easy to overlook your family as people who are kind of invested in like your best interests but sort of willing to call you out on being an idiot and stuff. And
yeah,
so I think a lot of people probably could do more with their family if they sort of thought about it.
Absolutely. They're not going to go away anytime soon, so you might as well get them to help you.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. So I think I should probably start rounding up. Have you got any questions for me?
What is the most consistent theme that has come out of all your 100 and whatever podcast is with all your guests? As in a theme on mindset?
So as in certainly having a mindset, like a growth mindset, has been a very consistent theme. And I think part of it is in, like we spoke about, I think sort of the curiosity and not having a full plan exactly and being willing to kind of just go with the flow and like learn and iterate as you improve and let like things get you down. So I guess more sort of not being so defensive. There's like the prevention versus promotion mindset. So as in if you were to win, you're going to win. Whereas if you're kind of playing to not lose, like you're more likely to lose kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And sort of not be caught up in your setbacks and kind of just constantly sort of having a more positive outlook to sort of see how you can make the most of a situation has really been like the point where people have usually kind of taken off, as in I think kind of that happens to everyone, and some people kind of happens but then they just stop, and it's usually been like those points always happen but it's led to something that then was the point that then gave someone their success. It's maybe some of the bigger themes, I guess. And it's a funny one because it's not exactly like one specific mindset which I've learned. So when I first started the growth mindset, it sort of seemed like sort of a bit more of an embodying mindset that kind of had all of them. But it's just because if you're into growth, then surely that means you get all the other ones. But you can have a growth mindset but actually be lacking in other ways, and so not be so successful. Think that you're always invested in your growth and sort of be constantly doing things to get better and have like the sort of like the peak performance kind of thing, where sort of everything that you practice is like the most important thing for you to be practicing, so you like learn more. But then you can kind of not acknowledge, then so there's a problem with some people who are quite smart, but they don't realize that they don't know everything, and so they'll get interested in something and they'll be learning it, but they'll think that they know more than you, so they won't actually be so curious to ask questions or like see where they're wrong on things. And so like there's other mindsets around like how you think about people and their value and whether they're going to be valuable for you, and like spending time listening to them. Even if you have a growth mindset, you can miss out on that. So I guess the main thing of that is that like it's a bit of everything and no one really knows what they're doing, but the people that are sort of consistently more positive around things and they just sort of see the best in everything, whether that's people or ideas or like situations, are the ones that kind of can then make them. I should probably practice that answer more often. I should probably just sit down for like a few hours and like write that out. I really enjoyed each year I kind of look back through all the podcasts and sort of make a summary of like the best lessons, and like those have been some really nice podcasts. I kind of like the last one kind of turned into almost a bit of a mini audiobook that I kind of put together, so they're quite good. Then I guess one thing I really like to ask people, well, there's two things. One is, what's one of your earliest memories?
I think it was probably just one of my first days at school, I think, and just being dropped off at the school gate in this very small school. And I remember the fear that I just left me. I'm in this, and it was a really old school where it was like 10 people in a class and you wore a baggy cap and a yellow jumper. And I just remember standing there and I'm actually like here by myself and I'm really, really young and overcome by fear by that point and be like, what's in front of me? And I was just one of the earliest memories I remember going gay and thinking, wow, this is really the unknown here.
That's funny. I really remember my first day at school as well. I didn't really talk much as a child, and so I was really shy and I was super scared my first day. And like, yeah, at school, I didn't really, I was quite dyslexic as well. And so I didn't always like learn in the best ways and found some things challenging. But yeah, the first day of school was there is sort of like a, wait, why are there all these scary people? And why is like, there's no one that I know and what's going on? Yeah.
That's funny.
Have you got any kids?
No. So, no kids.
Yeah, that's another big scary thing. I'm sure that's a
that's another podcast.
It is interesting the way like something stick with you. What has been the scariest thing that's ever happened to you?
I was in a car crash. I nearly died. That was probably the one that's probably the scariest. And I flipped my car over in the middle of a motorway when I was about 21, I think. And the policeman said to me, if I was in a different car, I would have died. So yeah. That's probably the scariest.
I mean, did it feel really scary at the time?
I thought to myself, this is what Lewis Hamilton probably feels like when he's driving an F1 car. That's what I thought. That's what went through my head.
Here's a weird thing. So I'm not sure if like I've been more scared of like trying to give a speech or something back when I was sort of completely unable to use my words compared to like times where I nearly died, when it was sort of like I actually got to the point where I thought I was dying a few times and wasn't really that scared at those points. I was like, oh, I'm about to die. I'll just try and think nice things for the next sort of minute. Yeah. That's all I've got left. Like, why'd I waste my time like panicking or anything? That's not in my agenda for like 60 seconds of all I can do with my life.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right.
It's hard to really like work that out. Yeah. Anyway, nice tangent.
Nice tangent.
Like a tangent. Okay. So then what's one of the kindest things that someone has done for you?
I was at university and I left university and did a placement year. And in this placement year, you have to go and find a job. And I had no experience at the time. Like I had nothing on my CV, barely anything. And there was a family friend of mine who I actually didn't know well at all. Right. And I'd met probably at that time, maybe once or twice. And I was looking for a placement and struggling a little bit. And he had a company and yeah, he met with me and I said, look, I'm looking for something. And, you know, I kind of gave him the spiel. And he's like, look, we don't really do placements. It's not something we do at the company, but, you know, give me the pitch of why you want it and why we should do it. So I gave him the pitch. And then he really took a gamble on me. He kind of saw something in me that I think I didn't see myself actually at the time. And he really backed me and said, look, I'm going to give you this. And basically, you know, it's not because I know you well, because he didn't know me well at the time. And he's just like, look, because I see something in you that basically that I think you'll do really well. And I just had so much drive to that point to do well. And they actually offered me a full-time job after I graduated by it. I went to UI instead, and the rest is kind of, I suppose, history. But to have someone like that, that have that kind of belief in you in a time where you're often, you don't know how much direction you have in your life, is a very powerful thing. And, you know, I do a lot of mentoring with different founders, obviously not outside of RLC Ventures, particularly founders that have come from refugee backgrounds, and having just someone that says, you know, you can do that, and at that, you know, a vulnerable point in your life, then this is a very powerful thing for people.
Yeah, definitely. I think certainly like the most rapid learning is when you're kind of a bit out of your comfort zone and being given the opportunity to make mistakes, and but not being sort of especially harsh is like the best thing that you can kind of do for people. So yeah, it's nice to sort of see how that happens. Have you found ways to kind of do that yourself with people?
Yeah, I've really got out my way to try and help young people and advise you. I do a lot of lecturing at universities, and we sponsor Oxford's VC Society, and we sponsored LSE's VC Society, and we did a scout program for university students from all different universities to help them get into VC. So we do lots of things with young people. We really believe that these guys, young people, they're going to be the people that bring us the next TikTok, right? Before these older guys like us now catch on to it. So you've got to stay down with the youth. It's not a reason to do it, but I think the reason is that they are the future, and like, and kind of change one person's life in a positive way. You've left some kind of legacy on the world, right?
Oh, that's lovely. Okay, and then just to wrap things up, where can people find out about you, and is there any sort of advice you'd have for people wanting to get in touch?
The best place to always get me is on LinkedIn. Full name's Bruce Chowdhury, and I will always endeavor to get back. If you all you have to do is put in your name, obviously, which it comes up with, just say I heard Sam's podcast and just reaching out. I'll always accept if people put like 2 seconds of effort into a message, and always look to kind of respond back if I when I get a chance.
It's an interesting one thing to know. My inbox has kind of exploded a lot the last few months, but it's a super useful tool. So glad that you're letting people still talk to you there and stuff. Cool. Then any like final parting words of wisdom or like favorite piece of advice that you've received?
My favorite quote in life is do one thing every day that scares you. And I think this is a good way to live your life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, 100%. What have you been doing then whilst during lockdown for do things that scare you?
This is limiting, but I try different. I think this is where I was trying, you know, I did a lot more kind of things like meditation. I did yoga, right? I tried to learn new skills, small things like I hadn't spoken to some people in 10 years and I just reached out to them and said, let's have a phone call. And, you know, sometimes those things are more scary than you imagine. You haven't spoken to somebody in 10 years. You don't know what that's like. And you know, lots of things have changed. And so I think they don't have to be, I think when people say that quote, they don't have to be like, oh my God, you're going to do a bungee jump today. But they can be very, very small things, which are like, you know, maybe it's just like saying to somebody you care about them and you don't usually say that, or you know, it's just something that's just slightly on the edge of your comfort zone and your normal kind of routine life, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. I'm fully agreeing with that. So yeah, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. And
no worries, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Happy to chat some more books with you in the coming months.
That'll be great.
All right,
really appreciate it.
Awesome,
thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser, and I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend, where we read and discuss a great non-fiction book a week, talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So it's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial and I just don't find it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason, but I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this. And obviously do invite your friends. It's all about friends. So you can find out more about Syncify app by going to syncifyapp.com. Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, please reach out to me through the website at growthmindsetpodcast.com. I do love talking to listeners. You can support us on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or telling a friend about us. But mostly, keep learning and keep growing.